Kaffee in seiner besten Form. Mit Cubo wird jeder Kaffee auf Knopfdruck zum Genussmoment. Denn mit der neuen Cubo One Kapselmaschine von Chibo genießt du feinsten Spitzenkaffee aus besonderen Anbaugebieten. Vollmundige Aromen dank innovativer Press-Brew-Technologie und über 17 Sorten Kaffee für jeden Geschmack. Erlebe Premium-Kaffee schon ab 29 Euro. Entdecke jetzt die Cubo Kapselmaschinen in deiner Chibo-Filiale und auf chibo.de.
Stu does America.
Follow the show on YouTube, youtube.com/StuDoesAmerica. By the way, you may have heard I'm going to be leaving the radio show in the new year. If you want to know what's going on next, you would go to youtube.com/StuDoesAmerica. Sign up there. I'll be still doing stuff here on Blaze TV. There's a bunch of new developments coming in the new year, and I would love for you to hang out with us. Subscribe wherever you can. Go to the social media stuff. We'll make sure you know what is going on. Some exciting stuff, I think, right around the corner. Brent Buchanan is here to explain the real reason the 2024 election went the way that it did. Are Republicans in trouble heading into 2026? There's some new midterm data to look at. We'll get into that. But we're also going to be starting by doing the Lost Generation. This is a story about DEI and what's going on with DEI and how it's affected us and how it's permeated through our society and changed the lives for thousands and thousands and millions of people. It really is a weird story. And of course, DEI is always in the news. Let me give you a quick taste as to what's going through the headlines right now. As some DEI critics say victory is near, companies face new pushback over rollbacks. I will say these people who've been pushing this nonsense on us are not going to go away easily. DEI died this year. Maybe it was supposed to, says Wired. Then we have what really comes after DEI from Fast Company. The questions are all out there. And I think at times we as conservatives look at this and say, look, there was an insane thing that happened. It's over now. We've won that battle. Let's move on. I don't think that's exactly true. And it certainly isn't true for the people who were in the middle or maybe the victims of this battle overall. There's a new piece in Compact called The Lost Generation by Jacob Savage. I'm going to walk you through some of this here. And I want to give you the outline of it. I will say, if you're interested in this sort of thing, if you think this is something that's an important topic, and I really do believe it is, I tell you to go read the whole thing. It's like 9,000 words. I mean, it's a very long read, very in-depth, but really, really interesting. Let me try to bring you through at least some of it here as we go through. This is where we start. 2011. This is the year he writes he went to move to Los Angeles. White men were 48% of lower-level TV writers. By 2024, it was just 11.9%. So 2011 to 2024, it went from 48% to 11.9%. The Atlantic's editorial staff went from 53% male to 36% male, and 89% white to 66% white. White men fell from 39% of tenure-track positions in the humanities at Harvard in 2014 to 18%, from 39 to 18%. In retrospect, 2014 was the hinge, the year DEI became institutionalized across American life. So he's setting this as 2014 being that real turning point. And I the evidence here, I had not really ever honestly thought about it this way, is why it's such an interesting piece. As the Trump administration takes a chainsaw to diversity, equity, and inclusion apparatus, there is a tendency to portray DEI as a series of well-meaning but ineffectual HR modules. This may be how Boomer and Gen X white men experienced DEI. But for white male millennials, DEI wasn't a gentle rebalancing. It was a profound shift in how power and prestige were distributed. This is the part that I hadn't really considered, honestly. You know, I'm a Gen X guy. Of course, you know, it's different for me being in the conservative media space. We never obviously embraced DEI. Was not something that was ever on our radar, honestly. It was more about who can do the job the best way. Like, that's the meritocracy lives in conservative media and a few other places, but not too many, certainly in this period. And what was interesting about this is that is kind of my perception of how DEI was in some of those companies, right? The annoying meetings, the stupid little, PowerPoint presentations, you know, but like, generally speaking, a lot of people rolled their eyes and moved on. In many fields, though, it was not that way. This isn't a story about all white men, he writes. It's a story about white male millennials in professional America about those who stayed and who mostly stayed quiet. The same identity a decade apart meant entirely different professional fates. If you were 40 in 2014, born in 1974, beginning your career in the late 90s, you were already established. If you were 30 in 2014, you hit a wall, because the mandates to diversify didn't fall on older white men, who in many cases still wield enormous power. They landed on us, he writes. A decade ago, prevailing critique of American journalism was that it was woefully lacking in gender and racial diversity. Again, it's important to know, not conservative journalism. That was not the critique there, because we, again, trying to look at merit. But there had been hope that new media would be different, that the internet might bring a wider range of voices. By the mid-2010s, that optimism was waning. Institutions pursuing diversity decided that there would be no backsliding. If a position was vacated by a woman or person of color, the expectation was that it would be filled by another woman or person of color. Again, I'm going to probably say this word many, many times in the next few minutes. But that's just racism, okay? If you're taking someone who is one race and replacing them with a person of the same race, you are making a decision based on skin color. That's racism. That's what that is. That doesn't mean that the next person who happened to be a person of color or whatever was not qualified for the job or was not the best person for the job. But that's the reason they should get the job, that they're the best person. Not because of their skin color. That's not the way this is supposed to work. Now, it goes on. The truth is, after years of concerted effort, most news outlets had already reached and quietly surpassed gender parity. By 2019, the newsrooms of ProPublica, The Washington Post, and The New York Times were majority female, as were the new media upstarts Vice, Vox, BuzzFeed, and The Huffington Post. And then 2020 happened, and the wheels came off. In the aftermath of George Floyd's death, newsrooms tripped over themselves to stage a reckoning. The New York Times solemnly promised sweeping reforms on top of the sweeping reforms it had already promised. The Washington Post declared it would become the most diverse and inclusive newsroom in the country. CNN pledged a sustainable commitment to race coverage, and NPR went further still, declaring that diversity was nothing less than its North Star. Shouldn't the truth be your North Star if you're a journalistic organization? If you're NPR and your taxpayers are paying for your entire organization, or at least a giant chunk of it, maybe your North Star should be America, right? Maybe it should be patriotism. Maybe it should be certainly be the truth, but with the idea of making the country a better place, right? Diversity is, you know, it's a number keeping game to a lot of these people. The irony was, where older white men remained in charge, especially where they remained in charge, there was almost no room to move up. At the New York Times Magazine, one of the few prestige magazines with the public masthead, Jake Silverstein, a Gen X white man, serves as editor-in-chief. And Bill Wasik, another Gen X white man, serves as editorial director. But of nine millennial senior editors and story editors below them, there's just one white guy. And he's been there since 2012, effectively grandfathered in. Whoever that guy is, I feel bad. They're just saying, like, yeah, that guy, we're never going to promote him. he's going to be in whatever role he's in till the end of time. It is very interesting, right? Like, we all know this stuff was happening, but if you think about the mechanics of this, like, if your job is stated, we got to get the percentage of people of color up and the percentage of white people down, it's not the, like, people at the top of the chain with all the power that are like, they're implementing these policies, but that doesn't affect them. They're like, oh, wait a minute, we're staying. We want the gig. We want the money. But when we hire new people, hire a bunch of people who are maybe checking off some boxes for us so our overall percentages will look good. Does this sound like a good way to run a company or a country? I don't think so. Very bottom of the ladder, the picture is different. Since 2020, only 7.7% of Los Angeles Times interns have been white men. Think about that for a second. Again, if all the white people who show up and are idiots, okay, fine. I don't actually care what the percentage is. But this is a country of, what, roughly 70% white people? Only one-tenth? Of that percentage are interns going into the Los Angeles Times? I mean, it just sounds like maybe a decision has been made. And of course, that decision was made to not judge people solely by merit, but to judge them by their skin color. Again, we've learned over American history this is a bad decision. And yes, people of color were the victims of that terrible decision for a very long time, and that is important to note. However, the goal should not be the Ibram Kendi goal. The goal should not be the only solution to present discrimination is future discrimination. That is not a sensible way to handle this. The better way to handle this is to go after merit and be meticulous about it, to make sure it's the only thing. You know, that, there's that old story about what happened at Broadway, where they were worried that people were picking white people to, you know, be the violin players or whatever over people of different colors and backgrounds. And so they implemented something that was really, really smart: blind auditions. They said, hey, we're going to put it behind a screen and we'll say, hey, we're just going to listen and we will not care what you look like. It was kind of like The Voice, right? It was that type of approach. I think it's The Voice, or is it Masked Singer? It's one of them that does they do things like this. You're supposed to be judging people based not on what they look like or what their background is, but by their abilities. And that was implemented for a long time. Now it is out of favor. New York and in Broadway. Why? Because now they're saying it doesn't do the Ibram Kendi thing. It doesn't say, well, past discrimination, how do we solve that? How about present discrimination? No, because you can't tell who's behind the thing. You might hire too many white people. Always a bad decision. Don't make choices based on skin color, ever. Don't ever do it. It should be simple. It should be obvious to the American people. And I think it was for a really long time, but that seems to be going away. At the very bottom of the ladder, I said that. Okay, let me go a little bit further into this quote. Between 2018 and 2024, of the roughly 30 summer interns each year at Washington Post, just two or three were white men. In 2025, with some political changes going on, the intern class had seven white guys, numbers not seen since way back in 2014. In 2018, the New York Times replaced its summer internship with a year-long fellowship. Just 10% of the 220 fellows have been white men. By the early 2020s, many journalists I spoke to noticed something else. The young white men who once flooded internship and fellowship pools had simply stopped applying. Gen Z men had absorbed the message that journalism was not for them. I mean, I'm going to repeat myself here, but like, that's not good. It's not good for any race to think that they should not go into journalism. That's a bad idea. People should be going into journalism because they want to tell the truth. They want to give their perspective. There are lots of different backgrounds. People do look at things differently. You should have different opinions, of course. I mean, I don't know. The conservative opinions never seem to have a place. And at this point, we're just basically used to it, I suppose. Though we have seen even some improvement there since Trump came back into office, CBS News, even The Washington Post. There's been a few examples where, I mean, certainly Twitter, from a social media perspective, has been improved by some of these changes. But it really has hit journalism very, very hard. And we're going to get into a situation where it just frankly doesn't make any sense. We should not be judging people by their skin color. Now, let me go over to another field, as Compact Magazine does here in the piece. In less than a decade, the entire face of the industry changed. The New York Times newsroom had gone from 57% male to 46% male, from 78% white to 66% white. Okay, well, those aren't too far off the norms, but it's certainly a noticeable drop. Condé Nast, a little bit different, 35% male and 60% white. BuzzFeed, a media operation that used to be 52% male and 75% white in 2014, down to 36% and 52% white by 2023. So the drops again from 52% to 36% when it comes to males, and 75% to 52% when it comes to whites. When people look at academia, they still saw old white men, lots of them. White men may still be 55% of Harvard's arts and scientists faculty. Again, top of the chain, those people that came up before all this stuff started, they just kept their positions. They're like, we've got the power, we're staying here. White men might be a high percentage there, but this is a legacy of Boomer and Gen X employment patterns. For tenure track positions, this is the pipeline for future faculty, white men have gone from 49% in 2014 to 27% in 2024. In humanities, they've gone from 39% to 21%. The white men who do get hired are often older and more established, or, interestingly enough, foreign. Several people I spoke with noticed that European white men don't seem to face these barriers. The reason, one professor suggested, is that they exist slightly outside the American culture wars. Does this seem like a good way to run a country? That you're going to favor Europeans over your own citizens? Now, if you want to judge them equally and fairly, fine. I'm totally for that. But to favor foreigners coming into our society over American citizens, while American citizens don't have jobs, that seems a little kind of crazy, right? Now it goes to Hollywood. Fall of 2014, you remember this, the Oscars nominated only white people for acting awards, and Oscars So White was born. Ah, the day of the hashtag. The New York Times ran story after story. The Academy promised reforms, and as did the studios. They eventually delivered. A whistleblower sent me a document from early 2017, an internal needs sheet compiled by a major talent agency that shows how steep the headwinds were. Across the grid, which tracks staffing needs for TV's writers' rooms, the same shorthand appears dozens of times. Diverse, female, women and diverse only. If you're thinking about how this is going to be rectified and what the outcome is going to be from this particular era, let me draw you to one particular phrase in the next sentence. This is systematic discrimination documented in writing, implemented without consequence. Every fellowship, grant, and hiring incentive was suddenly oriented toward changing who got in the door. The Writers Guild lists more than a dozen studio-run initiatives for emerging diverse writers. Over and over and over again, and there's stories throughout the individual stories as well throughout this piece, discussing how people would actually say, yeah, we'd love to have you, but sorry, you're white. This, I mean, how could this happen? We all, I thought, learned from all of our racial mistakes from generations before you and I were alive. Those were really, really bad. In fact, some of you may have been alive for a good chunk of a really dark period in our racial history. And what I thought understood was that was wrong. You shouldn't say, hey, we'd love to give you this job, but unfortunately you're black. That's really bad. It's also bad. And you could argue equally as bad. To say, hey, you shouldn't get this job because you're white, because it's the same exact thought process. You're just changing the colors. Bad in both cases. For a decade, this kept going faster and faster. Without any actual quotas to achieve, only the constant exhortation to do better. The diversity complex became self-radicalizing, a strange confluence of top-down and bottom-up pressure. I was read that line, I was like, gosh, if I have not heard Glenn Beck make the point over again, top down, bottom up, inside out, right? This way of changing society is right there in the literature. No one ever said what the right number of white men would be, but it was always fewer than you currently had. That's racism. So again, to be clear, that is racism. The refuges of the young white men did wind up finding, which were crypto, podcasting, and Substack. They were refuges precisely because institutional barriers to entry didn't exist. If you didn't have, like in crypto, and people are just like, hey, get in here. Like that, the whole point of crypto is anyone can do it. Anyone can access it. Substack, anyone can do it. Any opinion can stand. Podcasting, anyone can do it. Anyone can have an opinion. Those things were a bunch of millennial white kids wound up growing up into an area where they couldn't get these other jobs, so they went into these areas. And, you know, I'm glad those areas do exist. More areas should appear like podcasting and Substack and crypto, where you can have just an open door for anyone who has the talent and has the ability to go in and achieve something. Is the media more trusted now than a decade ago? These are important questions to ask because basically the idea is, did this stuff work? If you're going to go here and make decisions based on the color of skin for a decade, what happens? Did things improve? Is the media now more trusted than a decade ago? I would say certainly not. Is Hollywood making better films or television? I mean, some television is really, really good. Some movies are really good, but it seems like the industry's fallen off. And when you go by box office receipts, you definitely say that. Is academia more respected? I'd say certainly not. Have these institutions become stronger since they systematically excluded an entire cohort? You could also write age, race and gender there. Or did abandoning meritocracy accelerate their decline? I think the answer to that is quite clear. Quite clear. They're going the wrong direction, and it seems to go faster and faster and faster. We're only now seeing a reversal of this to try to go back to the old days of at least attempting even with human weakness, even with the naive ideal that we're talking about here, but of a colorblind society. You can mock that idea. You can say it's stupid. You can say MLK was an idiot for thinking that we should ever look at people based on the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. But the fact that the left abandoned that idea didn't mean everybody else did. I think the American people, no matter what the race is, want a society that is thinking, at least aspiring, to be colorblind, to make decisions based on merit. Ends with this. Most of the men I interviewed started out as liberals. Some still are. But to feel the weight of society's disfavor can be disorienting. We millennials were true believers in race and gender-blind meritocracy, which for all of its faults, its naivete about human nature, its optimism in the human dream and in the American dream, it was far superior to what replaced it. And that's what we're dealing with now. And to see that vision so spectacularly betrayed has engendered a skepticism toward the entire liberal project that won't soon disappear. Look, I don't care about the liberal project. I think the liberal project basically sucks. But that being said, it's affected an entire party and it's driven an entire party to freaking insanity, to be honest with you. An entire party that just does not even attempt to make decisions based on logic. In fact, we've heard that logic can be a sign of racism. If you're requiring logic, well, then you're a racist. I don't think the American people really believe that. I think a bunch of lunatics, that the Ibram Kendis of the world think that way. I don't think most Americans do. But it does put us in a position where not only do we have to really understand what happened here, but we have to get back to a place to make it so that people who, an entire generation of people who were basically victims of this, have a path to be able to get their lives back. It's a long, long road. And until we recognize it and be able to kind of step back and say, how do we solve this? Not just for the people who are already victims of it and probably moved on to something else, but also for kids that are coming up now to have that future for themselves. If we don't get to that point, we've got a long, long, kind of dark road ahead of us. You know, most of the stress we feel around medical preparedness comes from one simple truth. We always kind of think everything's going to be there for us, right? We assume the system will work exactly the moment that we need it to work. We're all depending on that, unless we've thought ahead. Everyone who's out there, who's ever dealt with a pharmacy delay or a sudden power shortage or a travel hiccup, knows that doesn't always cooperate. Jace Medical was created to take that worry right off your shoulders. The Jace case gives you a supply of essential emergency medications and antibiotics packaged with clear instructions from real physicians so you know exactly when and how to use them. For people who rely on daily prescriptions, Jace Daily offers a full year's of a backup supply for whatever medication you're taking, something that can instantly shift your mindset from, I hope nothing happens, to I'm covered. No matter what, they also offer a first aid kit. They also offer specialized medication packs that make preparedness feel practical instead of overwhelming. What people appreciate most is the confidence that comes from finally having a plan and instead of, just hoping circumstances stay perfect. Go to jace.com, prepare yourself. Enter the promo code STU at checkout. Get a discount on your order. The promo code is STU at jace.com, jase.com. The code is STU.
Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer gut, immer günstig, immer vielfältig. Kurz gesagt, Frische für alle. Zum Aldi-Preis. Diese Woche Cespri Sangold Kiwi. Das Stück für nur 55 Cent. Oder dunkle Tafeltrauben. 500 Gramm für nur 1,79 Euro. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
I'm joined now by Brent Buchanan. He's the CEO of Signal, and he is the author of a brand new book. It's called America's Emotional Divide, Navigating the Powerful Decision-Making Forces Impacting Politics, Policies, and Personal Choices, which you can pick up wherever you get your books. Brent, it's a fascinating topic. Thanks so much for coming on and discussing it with me.
Hi, great to be with you, Stu.
Yeah, appreciate it, you coming on. This is an interesting way to think about not only the election, but I think everything we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis right now. Can you kind of walk us through why did you write the book? What inspired it?
Well, I'm a pollster by day and apparently author by night. And in doing polling, I think public polling gives what we do a bad name. Our job is to go in and help people understand what's going on. Why is it going on? How do I change opinions, hearts and minds? And by just figuring out what messages people responded to, you would go do that within a political campaign or a corporate campaign, and then nothing would change. And so it sent me down this rabbit hole of figuring out there's got to be something else beyond just logically having a conversation here. And it led me to the fact that there's tons of research showing that we as humans process all of our information emotionally, and then almost always make an emotional decision and then back it up with rationality, with logical thought, and justify that. So it really flipped a switch in me. And honestly, part of the reason that I'm glad Glenn Beck wrote the foreword for this book is that he's one of the first people who tuned me into this. What is going on in this world? What's going on with our government? What is going on? All these wild things that sounded like conspiracy theories at the time. But when you see them play out, you realize all these emotions at play and why it's driving us to this place of like hyper emotionality right now in America.
Yeah, it's interesting. You bring Glenn up. He wrote the foreword for the book. One of the things that Glenn is great at is he's a great storyteller, right? Like, you know, there are a lot of people who make really good points. I think Glenn makes good points, but he makes really good points, and he's able to kind of form them in a way that connects with people beyond the spreadsheets. Like, I'm a nerd. I like spreadsheets. I like polls. I like all that stuff. He's always had a really good ability to take that and kind of connect with people in a different way. And now you're kind of like using polling to show that that's pretty normal for people.
Yeah, exactly. And you can say the right thing to the right people in the right channel in the wrong way, and it lands flat. Those of you who have a spouse or a significant other probably know exactly what I'm talking about. Yes. And so if that exists in that intimate of a relationship, why does this not exist elsewhere? And the answer is that it does, but we just don't tend to think about all these factors, especially our politics, being driven by that same need for connection, which, as you mentioned, is best done through story.
How does this take me to like the 2024 election? How does something like this play out in an election like that?
Well, what a wild year that was for us, and hard to think that that's just a year ago at this point. But I use the 24 election, the presidential election specifically, as the case study to make the point of the emotions at play and some of these undercurrent facts of like media fragmentation, massive distrust in institutions, and other factors that I think are juicing the emotions. And let me give you an example of this. It was definitely an inflation conversation driven emotion or election to start with. However, what did the Trump campaign spend the most advertising dollars behind? And it was the Kamala Harris is for they, them, Trump is for you ad and variations of it, using her own words about sex changes for prisoners and children. That is not an economic topic by any stance, but it is a deeply emotional cultural topic. And if the Trump team felt that it was imperative to spend that much money behind an issue that had nothing to do with economics or inflation, it bears out the fact that people make these decisions emotionally and not necessarily rationally.
Yeah, I mean, the whole election was incredible. It was an emotional roller coaster ride. I remember after watching the assassination attempt on Donald Trump, like my emotions in that moment were just like, if we can't reward this behavior, I don't care what it means after this. Like Trump has to win just from the fact to punish people from thinking there's an incentive there to try to shoot somebody in public, right? Like we all connected with that event, with the Biden back and forth and him pulling out and all that was very emotional. The whole thing was very emotional. And like, just like you try to get Hollywood does this very well. They will try to get their political points done through messaging, through films and different creative products. It seems like that's an approach that even if you don't like it, you have to be aware of it and you have to figure out how to address it.
Well, and if you want to have a logical, rational conversation and get data points across, that's fine. It's just you can't lead with it because everybody is biologically built to ask themselves, is this safe? And is this making me more secure? And so when it comes to politics, that is the first thing that they need to feel from the person who is speaking to them. And if they feel that that actually creates a biological, a chemical in the brain connection between a voter and somebody running for office. And then at that point, you can have other conversations. So it's not that elections or corporate ad campaigns or anything have to be blatantly and only emotional. It's just that that is the initial way that we connect and understand and relate. And so candidates specifically who come in and try to bullet point you to death over their ideas or their background or their biography, it just falls flat. And it only falls flat because you didn't start with that heart connection first.
Is this universal throughout our history? Is this a new phenomenon that people are reacting more to emotions?
Sue, that's a great question. And I think that it is how we are biologically wired. God created us this way, which means it's for good and it's for our good and it's for his purpose. However, there's just a lot of factors. If you think back to, 1,000 years ago, 150 years ago, we didn't have social media. We did not have this constant bombardment of advertisements. Mm-hmm. Like the amount of information that is coming at us on a constant basis, we had no clue what all wars were happening in the world and what happened that day in every given war. We didn't know about every crisis going on across the whole country or around the globe. And it's just a lot to take on. I mean, think about there are two types of people in this world. There are those who have a couple browser tabs open in their Internet Explorer and those who have 400 tabs open. And there's really no in between those two types of people. And we all are now the 400 browser tab brain in what all we have going on and thinking about and coming at us. And that really hyperactivates this emotional reaction because we have to take in and understand and sort through and make decisions on so much more. So we're really overloading that primal part of the brain that 150 years ago didn't have that much coming at it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was reading the thesis of the book before we had even asked you to come on. And, I looked at it and I was like, I think this is true, but I'm also concerned it's not necessarily good, right? Like where you have this thing where emotions are, if we kind of like put our position in looking at the left, for example, we see it with like things like gender. And there's, the woman with the story on radio today where the woman came in and saw a woman at Target wearing a Charlie Kirk red shirt and was just like screaming at her and just acting like an insane person. And like when I look at that on the left, I feel like, emotions, of course, are part of life and they help you experience things in amazing ways, love and adventure and all these crazy things. But like when you come down to making a decision as to who should be leading our country and designing our policy, I mean, shouldn't we get to the spreadsheets a little more often?
We should, but we also have to understand that the backdrop of life now is this hyper emotionality, this fragmentation. And so we have to learn how to work within it. And I think the left has actually done a really good job at this. And it's why they're able to flip the switch on their folks so easily. But it's also the construct in which the left thinks and operates. And that is under an oppressed and oppressor context. And if everybody is oppressed and you need to deal with an oppressor, how do you deal with an oppressor? Well, you assassinate them. The things that are okay in an oppressed oppressor context is not at all what we on the right, who believe in a right and wrong context, would ever consider to be done. And a lot of that is that biological, the emotional driven piece. And so if the right wants to win more hearts and minds, then we have to realize this is the construct in which we need to operate. We can actually use it to our good for other people's good.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like your research backs up the thinking of Jonathan Haidt in his book, the idea that we have to understand when we're communicating to people, particularly when we're trying to persuade them, right? Like you can talk to your base and that's great. And you need those people, of course, at the polls. But when you're trying to persuade people who might be coming from a different perspective, if you don't connect with them first, I mean, you're pretty much lost, right?
Completely. And because we're all asking this question of ourselves when we interact with anybody, whether it's President of the United States as a candidate or somebody you walk into and meet at Target, is does this person understand somebody like me? And Donald Trump really, whether it's totally intentional or not, completely gets this piece. And it's proven in the fact that you had 70 something million Americans say a loud, brash billionaire from New York City understands somebody like me. He crossed that threshold with folks and earned the opportunity to have the spreadsheet conversation to have. I mean, heck, when he was shot at in Butler, Pennsylvania, he was looking at a data chart and pointing it out to folks.
That's true. That's true. I always say the chart saved his life. Well, actually, I'll go with God, but still, that's a totally different story. Last one for you here. If you're advising some candidate coming up and looking to run for Senate or president maybe in 2028, what's your message here with all the research you've been able to put together?
It's like any relationship. You have to meet people where they are. You have to make them feel understood. And you've got to take that and figure out where do I mesh where people are and what I want to convey so they hear it in a way that matters to them, so that then I turn them around to get them to do the activity I want, which is to show up and vote for me. And I know that sounds incredibly simplistic, but the ability to get somebody who's running for office to slow down enough to understand what somebody's going through. It's one of the reasons that I love focus groups, and I like making my clients sit on the other side of the glass of the focus group, because I want them to hear how regular people talk and think and connect ideas and describe challenges that they're going through and desires for change that they want to see from their elected officials. And so anybody running for office or running a company or advancing a cause, like, these are really important things to take into consideration, that the backdrop of life is that in which you have to operate under. And if you don't understand that backdrop for people and where their heart is and where their attention is, it's part of the reason that I think Republicans are struggling right now so much with the affordability issue. Is it's not that we're not doing anything to address the issue. I mean, I think we're going to see a really amazing economy, come second quarter of next year. But the problem is regular people don't feel like Republicans or Trump specifically understand what they're going through. It's not that they don't believe that he is trying to make it better. It's they don't believe he's thinking about this and worried as much as they are about it. And that, at the end of the day, is the way we connect with people, is making them feel heard and understood.
That's a great book for you to read if you're a business owner, if you are thinking about running for office someday. Really, any time you have to connect with human beings, which is pretty much everybody. Brent Buchanan, CEO of Signal, the Republican polling firm, and they guys have done great work with your polling as well. So thanks for all your hard work there. The book is called America's Emotional Divide: Navigating the Powerful Decision-Making Forces Impacting Politics, Policies, and Personal Choices. You can pick this up wherever you get your books. Brent, it's great stuff, man. Thanks so much for coming on.
Okay, thank you, Stu.
I want to do a couple of updates to the two segments you just watched, because there's a couple interesting things have happened here in the last little bit. First of all, this one was actually overnight, but off-cycle elections send Republicans a clear midterms warning. We've talked about this a little bit, but you could see the chart here kind of illustrates it well. This is from Axios. Change in vote margin for select off-cycle elections for 2024 to 2025. And what you see in 8 examples, including five congressional races and three others, which is Miami mayor, New Jersey governor, and Virginia governor, every single one of those races has moved toward the Democrats since 2024. This is concerning, boys and girls, and it's concerning mainly because we've said this before, but you're supposed to lose. You're supposed to lose anyway. There is a piece in Politico that will also give you a little bit of the other side, in that there's not as many up for grabs races as there usually are, even in the House this time, and redistricting might help that, which is why they're being, Trump saw this in advance and has been very, very aggressive trying to push states to redistrict. That will help, but it's going to be difficult for the House especially to remain in Republican hands. That kind of coming off of our conversation we just had about elections and how to win them. Secondarily, let's go back to our first break. Remember, we talked about the DEI initiatives as they went through various industries, including Hollywood. And I wanted to bring back this quote, because this actually happened just as we were going through the taping. This is a quote I want to focus you on from the initial monologue that started the show. Is the media more trusted now after a decade of DEI? Is Hollywood making better films and television? Is academia more respected? Have these institutions become stronger because they systematically excluded an entire cohort? Or did abandoning meritocracy accelerate their decline? As we're going through that story, as we're doing the show today, this announcement comes out, which is, in the industry, I have to acknowledge, jaw-dropping. It really is. The Oscars will move to YouTube in 2029, leaving longtime home of ABC. ABC has been doing the Oscars for like, you know, what, 50 years? And now YouTube is coming in. There is this battle, a back and forth between these new tech companies and these new video delivery services, the Netflixes, the YouTubes of the world, versus the old school studios and broadcast entities. And that battle has been going on for a while. This is just another example. We just saw Netflix acquire Warner Brothers. It's another example of the tech companies winning. In this entire world of how you get your entertainment and information is changing, and the tech companies are winning. We're going to have a totally different delivery system. Now, look, the old delivery system sucked in a lot of ways. But it is important when you have institutions being overturned for new ones to acknowledge that and understand what it means. Might be better. Honestly, for conservatives, there's a chance that it's a little bit better. We know that these institutions on the tech side, when we're talking about the YouTubes and the Netflixes, are not conservative institutions, but at least maybe we have a chance in that field. We seem to be blocked out of the Hollywood system for a very long time. All right, back in a second. All right, I got about four stories to get to in about 2 minutes. I'm just going to do my best. Bear with me here. We're going to fly through these. Trump says he'll deliver a primetime address tonight. We don't know exactly what it is. Seems like it's going to be some economy stuff, some surprises, apparently, according to Levitt. So we'll see how that goes. Trump is designating Venezuela and their government a terrorist regime and ordered a blockade of sanctioned oil tankers. They say they have the biggest armada ever seen surrounding the country. I mean, again, I hope tonight isn't an announcement of a war, but who knows? Honestly, at this point, it is going down a very dark road with Venezuela. They're a horrible regime, and I want Maduro out. Hopefully, though, it doesn't lead to actual war if we can handle it. Maryland is going to consider slavery reparations after Governor Wes Moore wound up vetoing this, and it was overridden. To understand how bad this plan is, it's so insane that the liberal Democrat African-American governor of Maryland said, no way, we shouldn't do this. And Maryland's still like, yeah, let's go forward with it. It's great. I love this quote. The topic isn't easy, but again, without formal study of reparations risk being dismissed as symbolic or unconstitutional, regardless of moral merit. Well, they are symbolic, they are unconstitutional, and they do not have much moral merit. That I will say. Other than making you feel good, but you're basically punishing people who are alive today and didn't commit the crimes, and rewarding people who weren't alive then and didn't, weren't the victims of the crimes. That's not how our justice system works. And finally, let me leave you with this: what do Americans think about giving cash as holiday gifts? They really like it. Look, about 90% of every age group says, "Yeah, sure, you can give me cash." That's the least surprising poll in the history of polling, but now you know the results on Stu Does America. Okay, so here's what happened. What they have noticed over the past few years is that kids are expensive. Have you noticed this? Really, really expensive. And it's so nice of the glorious IRS to give us these deductions for our kids, our dependents, right? We have to spend money on them. And it's good that we're not just leaving them out in the cold, right? So we're spending money on them. We can deduct some of that off our taxes. It's so nice for the government to take slightly less of our own money. That I appreciate so much. But if you've ever had pets, you might also realize that they are also expensive and you're also responsible for them. So, simple question. From a woman, she is suing the IRS to get pets classified as dependents and eligible for tax deductions. Here's a little Finnegan. He says, she's just like my daughter. That's Finnegan, the golden retriever. By the way, if your dog can write its name in the snow like that, I think you should get a deduction for it. I'm just saying right there. Now, let me give you a separate recommendation. It's right here in this cup, this wonderful cup I hold in my hands. Repeal the 16th Amendment. I'd rather have that and have all the taxes go away than dogs as dependents, but that's, maybe that's just me. All right, you can get gift cards, a great gift for the holidays. Blaze TV gift cards are here. Go to giftblazetv.com, use the code STU20, save 20%. Giftblaze.com, the code is STU20.
Sehr gut, sehr gut, sehr gut.
Sehr gut?
Wieso Steuer ist sehr gut? Das sagen ganz viele.
Cool, wer sagt das?
Stiftung Warentest, Computerbild, Focus Money, Chip, Finanztipp, such dir was aus.
Mega, aber das ist doch bestimmt kompliziert.
Nö, einfach Foto von der Lohnsteuerbescheinigung machen und fertig.
Klingt sehr gut.
Ist sehr gut. Hol dir dein Geld zurück mit Wieso Steuer.